So next I'm happy to introduce Ali Lorenz. She is going to be doing a presentation on the impact of environmental policy on children's exposure, examining trends in biomonitoring of 5 environmental chemicals. Ali Lorenz received her MPH in 2011 from Emory University, where she was involved in research on pesticide exposure among pregnant women in Thailand. She is currently a fellow through the Association of Schools of Public Health at US EPA Office of Children's Health Protection. In this position, she supports science and regulatory policy activities such as the America's Children and the Environment Report and EPA's review of ambient air and quality standards for lead. So let's welcome Ali Lorenz.
Thank you, Amiko, for that introduction and for organizing and moderating the session. And thank you, everyone, for coming today. I'd like to talk to you about a project I've been working on as part of my fellowship at the EPA through the Association of Schools of Public Health in their Children's Health Office. But before we get into the presentation, I would like to tell you that I have no financial relationships to disclose, and that although ASPH and EPA both supported this presentation, the findings and conclusions do not represent their official views. These are my views. So today we'll talk about some trends in children's exposure over time and list some factors that might influence these trends. I'll also talk about the potential impact of some policy actions on trends in children's exposure to lead, mercury, perfluorochemicals, bisphenol A, and perchlorate. And you'll see I put in here selected policy actions because I have kind of a lot to cover in a short amount of time, so I'm just going to pull out a few examples. But if you go onto the website, the handouts have more of the policy actions that have happened over this time. And if you have questions about these, I invite you to talk to me after the presentation or email me. I'll also talk about some opportunities for decreasing children's exposure through policy in the future. First, I'd like to give a little bit of background on children's environmental health. Children have different environmental exposures from adults like you and I. For example, they can be exposed to chemicals through breastfeeding and prenatal exposure. There are also physiological differences that children have. For example, their immune systems are still developing. And behavioral differences are key as well. For example, children exhibit hand-to-mouth behavior. And all of this adds up to the fact that children often have higher exposures and may process chemicals differently in the body than adults. So they're often more susceptible to environmental threats, and thus they may experience the most benefit from environmental policy. So as Amiko mentioned, I work on the America's Children and the Environment report at EPA. And this is a periodic report that compiles data from various government sources, including NHANES, which is where the data for this presentation come from. And we're currently working on the third edition, and that's the source of the analyses in this presentation. And if you'd like more information, you can visit the website. As I mentioned, the biomonitoring data used in the ACE report and that I'll be talking about are from NHANES, which we already heard a little bit about, so I won't go too much into depth about the methods. And through this survey, the NHANES measured environmental chemicals in individual participants in their blood and urine. And children of all ages actually participate, but the age groups differ by chemical. So you'll see for lead, it's measured all the way down to children age 1. But for other chemicals, they're not measured in children's samples in NHANES. We'll also talk about some data from women of childbearing age, because that's another life stage of concern for children's health due to prenatal exposures. We'll start with lead. Lead is perhaps the most well-known environmental toxicant, and the most sensitive health effect for children that's associated with lead is neurological, including IQ loss, and this occurs at very low blood lead levels. In fact, no safe level of lead exposure has been identified. Next, I'd like to tell you a little bit about some of the exposure sources for lead so that you can get an idea of some of the potential targets for intervention through policy. In the 1970s and 1980s, when you'll see the NHANES data begins, the three major sources of lead exposure were leaded gasoline, soldered food cans, and lead-based paint. But today, the main sources of lead exposure for children in the U.S. are deteriorating lead-based paint and dust that's contaminated with lead. but lead is also found in drinking water and a number of consumer products. Here you see the NHANES data for lead in children ages 1 through 5, and you can see that the median blood lead level declined significantly, almost 92%, between 1976 and 2010. In 1978, the Consumer Product Safety Commission banned the residential use of lead-based paint. And that same year, EPA set their first national ambient air quality standard for lead at 1.5 micrograms per cubic meter. That level was recently updated in 2009 when it was decreased by tenfold to 0.15 micrograms per cubic meter. In 1986, EPA completed the primary phase-out of leaded gasoline, which I said was one of the major sources of exposure prior to this policy. And this is often cited as one of the primary reasons we see this decline in blood lead levels in children. And that phase-out was initiated in 1975. In 1996, EPA and HUD began requiring landlords to inform their residents about lead-based paint hazards in older homes. And I actually just moved into an apartment in downtown DC and received one of these notices when I moved in, which was in one point bad because that means there's lead-based paint in my apartment. But on the other hand, it's nice to see the policy in action. And you see here some of the other regulations fill in that are included in the handouts that are posted online, but I don't have time to talk about these all in detail, obviously. So if you have questions, you can ask me after the session. I also have a couple of copies of the handouts if anyone's interested. So you see the NHANES, the last NHANES update was in 2010, but since then there have been a couple more actions on lead that I'd like to just mention. In May of this year, the CDC lowered their blood lead reference value to 5 micrograms per deciliter, and this is a level at which the CDC recommends public health actions be initiated, and it's used to identify children and environments that are associated with lead exposure hazards. You also see here listed a number of regulations that are currently under development at EPA, including potential updates to the air quality standards for lead and drinking water regulations for lead. We'll move on to another heavy metal, mercury. Again, the most sensitive health effect for children is neurological, including delays in reaching developmental milestones from exposure to methylmercury. And the prenatal exposure period is the most sensitive. The primary exposure route for methylmercury is the consumption of contaminated fish and marine mammals. And these fish are contaminated as mercury bioaccumulates up the food chain when it's released into the environment from a number of emission sources, such as medical waste incinerators, municipal waste combustors, and coal-fired power plants. And in the early 1990s, some of the other sources I mentioned were important emission sources, but by 2005, coal-fired power plants were responsible for over half of anthropogenic mercury emissions. And although U.S. emissions have decreased more than 50% in the past 20 years, they might account for as little as 3% of global emissions, and that includes anthropogenic and natural emissions. So you can see that even if the EPA and other federal agencies lower emissions in the U.S., there's still some international sources that can come into play because mercury moves around the whole globe. And I'd like to note that the NHANES data that we're about to look at measures total blood mercury. It's expected to be representative of methylmercury exposure. And when we talked about the exposure and health effects, I focused on methylmercury because that's the form we're most often exposed to and where we see health effects at the lowest levels. And when I talk about the regulations, I'll cover all forms of mercury because the other forms, when they're released in the environment, can be converted into methylmercury, which people can then be exposed to. You see here that the median concentration of mercury has not changed for either women of childbearing age or children since 1999. It has remained relatively stable, I should say. In 2004, the EPA and FDA published advice on fish consumption for women of childbearing age and young children, and this included safety tips such as avoiding fish that contain high mercury levels and eating only two meals a week or 12 ounces of fish and shellfish. The following year, EPA issued the Clean Air Mercury Rule, which established a cap and trade system to reduce mercury emissions from coal-fired power plants. but I'm sure some of you may be familiar with this. In 2008, a court decision vacated the clean air mercury rule. The court ruled that the rule was too weak, and it failed to establish mandatory standards for lowering emissions, instead relying on a cap and trade program. So it's important to note that since 2005, there's been regulatory uncertainty for this group of the major source of mercury emissions. In 2005, EPA issued final standards for hazardous waste combustors, and the compliance was required by 2008. So as EPA has been working on regulations for the largest source of emissions, there have also been a number of regulations that address other sources of U.S. emissions. And not wanting to wait for national regulations, almost a dozen states had established regulations to control mercury emissions from coal-fired power plants by 2007, including my home state of Delaware. And here are some more policies that are on the handouts. I'd also like to point out that although the median levels of mercury in the blood did not change significantly during the time period, the 95th percentile actually did decrease for children, but it actually was not significant for women over the entire time period, though the decline you see between 1999 and 2002 was significant. So some of the population that experienced the highest exposures were seeing a decline in their exposure. In December of 2011, EPA issued the mercury and air toxic standards for power plants, which did address that largest source of emissions. Next January, there will be the final meeting of the United Nations Intergovernmental Negotiating Committee for Mercury, and we'll wait to see if any sort of international agreement on reducing mercury emissions comes out of that. The U.S. ban on mercury exports also goes into effect in January, and you see here there's a number of regulations currently under development at EPA, including regulations under the Clean Air Act and the Toxic Substances Control Act. Perfluorochemicals, or PFCs, have less of an established database for health effects for children, but some potential effects are developmental and reproductive, including low birth weight and delays in postnatal growth. PFCs have been used in industrial production since the 1950s in products such as carpets that are stain-resistant, nonstick cookware, I'm sure you've heard of Teflon, and packaging products. The PFCs with the highest production volume are PFOA and PFOS, and the primary exposure pathway is expected to be food, but the exposure sources are not as well understood, and they may include other sources as well. You can see here in the NHANES data the median concentration of both of these chemicals in blood of women of childbearing age declined significantly between 1999 and 2008. In 2000, 3M began the voluntary phase-out of PFAS and related chemicals. And at that time, 3M was the only U.S. manufacturer of PFAS, so that was obviously a very effective way to address that. As that voluntary phase-out ended in 2002, EPA published two significant new use rules, which prevented those chemicals that had been phased out from coming back onto the market. In 2006, EPA launched a similar program with 8 major companies that either produced or used PFOA in their product content, and these companies pledged to phase out PFOA in their products by 2015 completely. But it's important to note that these were not all of the companies that produced or used PFOA, so this may not be as effective as the 3M voluntary phase-out. The following year, states began to develop their own drinking water guidelines for PFOA, including New Jersey and Minnesota. In January of 2009, EPA issued their own health advisories for short-term exposure to PFOA and PFOS in drinking water. And these are not legally enforceable, but they're set as somewhat of a guideline for states to potentially use. In December of 2009, EPA issued their action plan for PFCs, which including investigating whether EPA could take any action under TSCA to regulate PFCs. This July, the FDA announced a voluntary phase-out of chemicals similar to PFOA in food wrappers, which you might have heard about a little bit in the news. Moving on to bisphenol A. BPA might be an endocrine disruptor that could cause developmental, reproductive, immunological, and behavioral effects. It's used in epoxy resins and polycarbonate plastics, which are found in a huge number of products, including food and drink containers, contact lenses, which surprised me when I found that out, and thermal paper receipts. And diet is thought to be the most common source of exposure, but exposure through other media may also occur. It's important to note here when we look at the NHANES data that the urinary BPA levels reflect only recent exposure. So keep that in mind as we look at this. You can see here that for children in the dark blue, the median concentration of BPA declined over this time period, but it did not decline significantly for women in the lighter blue. In 2008, a number of manufacturers and retailers decided to phase out certain products containing BPA. And in 2010, a number of states and the city of Chicago banned certain children's products that contain BPA, including baby bottles and sippy cups. That same year, EPA issued their action plan for BPA, which again will investigate whether there's regulatory action under TSCA that the agency would be authorized to take. Between 2011 and 2012, bans on BPA in children's food and drink containers went into effect in a number of additional states. And in March of this year, FDA denied a petition to eliminate BPA from food packaging and cited the need for continued scientific research. It's important to note that this decision was based on data that was available up to 2008 because that's when the petition was filed. So there might be some more recent evidence that would prompt them to change their mind on this, and they're currently considering that. In July of this year, the FDA actually did decide to ban BPA in baby bottles and sippy cups at the request of industry, who had already eliminated that from their products. Perchlorate is known to block uptake of iodide into the thyroid gland, and it's thought that iodide deficiency in pregnant women might lead to neurodevelopmental deficits in their offspring, but again, these health effects aren't as well established as for chemicals like lead and mercury. Perchlorate is mostly used in the manufacture of rocket fuel, fireworks, explosives, etc. But it may also leach from natural sources in soil during irrigation. And it's thought that the main source of exposure is drinking water as well as food. And again, here urinary perchlorate levels reflect only recent exposure. You can see here that the median concentration of perchlorate did not change over this time period for either children in the dark blue or women in the light blue. In 2005, EPA issued a recommended drinking water equivalent level, and again, this was not an enforceable level. It was meant to be set as a guideline for states or local authorities. And this exposure level assumed that 100% of your exposure comes from drinking water, so you'll see that later EPA lowered this level because they also considered food as a source of exposure. The following year, Massachusetts enacted an enforceable drinking water standard for perchlorate, which notably was much lower than the 24.5 parts per billion that EPA had recommended. And California followed in 2007. In 2008, EPA issued that interim drinking water health advisory for perchlorate, which also considered food exposure and was lower at 15 parts per billion. In February 2011, EPA did decide to develop enforceable drinking water standards for perchlorate, and that's currently under development at EPA. So in conclusion, we see that policies, including regulations and voluntary efforts that are initiated at the national level, appear to have played a role in reducing exposure to lead and PFCs. However, we see with mercury that although many regulations have addressed mercury, the national policy efforts have only recently addressed the largest source of emissions in the U.S., and we also saw that mercury emissions outside of the U.S. remain high, so the median exposure level, we don't really see a decline yet. It's also important to recognize that the lag time between a policy and its potential impact may differ by chemical. So, for example, mercury might take a little bit longer to get out of the environment once those emissions are decreased because it accumulates up the food chain and it's in the environment. And finally, we saw that levels of exposure to BPA and perchlorate have remained relatively stable over time in the absence of comprehensive and enforceable federal policy, which is on its way. So thank you, and you can feel free to contact me by email if you have questions about those specific regulations, or as I said, I have handouts with me. I'd also like to put in a little plug for a colleague of mine who's doing a presentation tomorrow from 2:30 to 4. If you're interested in how children's health has impacted the development of some of these regulations that I've talked about, you should go to that talk and hear what he has to say. Thank you, and I think I can take a couple of questions for clarification. Maybe one question. Sorry. Yes.
Maybe we can sort of the quick policy that you flash on there, but I think it's worth noting that CDC, the Child and Neglect Prevention Program, has been virtually defunded.
Yes.
So it would be interesting to see what impact that might have.
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you for bringing that up.
What was the name of the talk that you wanted to talk for tomorrow?
Matthew, what's the name of your talk?
Along the lines of protecting reproductive and children's health through policy.
That's the session, yeah.